and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for March 12, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, parent-offspring conflict among birds, ocean versus land biodiversity, and peace through vaccine diplomacy. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the genes for pain from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
When canary birds hatch, they get their food by begging their parents for it. Of course, that begging wears them out, just as it wears the parents out to go get more food to satisfy their begging chicks. And that's a potential source of parent-offspring conflict, because it's not good for either the parents or the chicks to be worn out. Worn-out mothers lay fewer eggs the next time, and worn-out chicks grow more slowly and are less fit. But as Rebecca Kilner and colleagues report in a paper in this week's Science, canaries are also co-adapted with their offspring, and mothers send a prenatal signal to their chicks about how much to beg once they hatch. I spoke with Kilner from her office at the University of Cambridge.
We have shown that mothers can communicate, mother birds can communicate with their chicks before they even hatch by leaving them messages in the egg about the conditions that they'll face after they hatch. And chicks respond to these messages by adjusting their begging behavior. And by doing so, they save themselves energy, and so they're able to grow more efficiently than if the message hadn't been left by the mother in the first place. This is interesting scientifically because we've known about these sorts of messages in the egg for roughly 20 years or so, but the assumption has been that they serve the evolutionary interests of the mother rather than the chick. So they're some kind of gag on over-demanding offspring. What we've shown experimentally is that assumption is wrong, that these substances favour the evolutionary interests of the chick primarily, and they benefit their mothers only indirectly through the consequences for their offspring.
And what species were you and your team studying?
We were focusing on canaries because they can be bred easily in captivity.
So you say that the benefit isn't necessarily to the mother. This is not then a co-adaptation.
So the mother benefits because obviously the mother will gain an advantage if her offspring flourish. But she doesn't benefit personally herself. She benefits only because her offspring flourish. So if we muck up this system of communication between the mother and her offspring, which we did experimentally, it's not the mother who suffers. It's the chick that suffers primarily. And they suffer because they waste energy begging inappropriately. So they either don't beg enough, and so they don't gain the resources that are available from their begging display, or they beg too much, and they waste effort on begging that they could otherwise devote to growing. So that's why the chicks gain from these messages left by their mother.
Ideally, then, under this co-adaptation, offspring will beg for food at the rate their parents can provide it?
Exactly. That's the goal, that the offspring match their begging performance to the generosity of their parents. And the mothers sort of tell them in advance how generous the parents are going to be by leaving this message.
So this message comes through prenatally, you say.
Yeah.
When does it go wrong? Is it something in the environment that changes so that there's not as much food, or genetic variation, or what?
When does it go wrong in our experiments, or when does it go wrong in nature?
In nature first.
Well, as far as we know, it doesn't go wrong in nature. We don't know, but we mucked things up experimentally in the lab.
Can you extrapolate to nature at this point?
Well, we know that there are prenatal effects on offspring development in nature, in naturally living birds. We don't know that they function in exactly the same way as in the species that we've studied, partly because it's very difficult to do the kinds of experiments that we've done in nature because it involves tracking individuals over a very long time frame, and obviously they disappear or die for reasons unconnected to your experiment. So that's the advantage of working on a captive species, is that we can look at things in a relatively benign environment and be certain that our experiments are responsible for any changes that we see. So it could well be happening in nature. It's just very difficult to know at this point.
So how did you muck it up then, as you said, experimentally?
By translocating or cross-fostering entire clutches of eggs between parents. So the chicks sitting in the egg would receive a message not from the parent that reared them. So they'd get the wrong message about the environment in which they were going to hatch, and they would perform inappropriate begging display for the generosity of the parents who would be rearing them. So it's a bit hit and miss because we can't know in advance who's going to be a generous parent or how chicks are going to beg. So we just rely on the natural variation in the population to cause this experimental manipulation. But luckily, there is quite a lot of variation. And so just by doing this enough times, we end up with sufficient combinations of begging and parental generosity to tease apart the effect of the prenatal substances on offspring versus maternal fitness.
The generosity of the parents respond by trying to get more food when the offspring are begging.
They do, but only up to a certain ceiling. So there's a kind of intrinsic limit that parents put on their generosity, even in the lab. It's quite extraordinary, even though we give them much more food than they could possibly eat. They don't give all of it to their chicks. There's a limit on how hard they're prepared to work to feed their chicks, which is intrinsically determined and which we've shown in previous experiments is correlated, in the case of mothers at least, with their testosterone levels. So we can increase maternal generosity by giving them extra food in the run-up to breeding, and then that will also increase their testosterone levels. But every individual does not respond in the same way. There's an intrinsic limit on how generous parents will become.
So the message from the parent to the chick or the mother to the chick is in testosterone, or is that the only?
Yeah, we don't know. That's the most plausible. It could be many substances, but the most plausible of the cocktail that's likely to be involved is maternal testosterone. And that's because we know from the pioneering work that Hubert Schwabel did on this in the early 90s, he actually worked on canaries then, and he showed for the first time that mothers deposit these small quantities of maternal testosterone in the egg yolk when they make the egg. And he subsequently showed in his experiments that the amount of testosterone they deposit is correlated with, he showed in his experiments with photoperiod. And then we've shown more recently in canaries that it's correlated with the amount of food available in the run-up to breeding, so just prior to egg manufacturing.
So you and your team, with your experiment in mucking up this parent-offspring matching, the parents wear themselves down to provide more food, and the offsprings wear themselves down in begging for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the conflict then between these two.
Yes, so the conflict is that the parents have to balance the effort that they devote to their current reproduction with effort that they have left over to breed again in the future. So there's a kind of balancing act between how much effort they put in now and how much effort they'll have to breed again in a year's time, say. And the problem is that the offspring balance the trade-off between current and future reproduction differently to the parents. And that's because the offspring value themselves twice as highly as their future siblings, whereas the parents are equally related to all of their young, current or future. And so the offspring are constantly trying to seek resources that parents would prefer to withhold for reproduction in the future.
And you said previously that the offspring are the ones that are always benefiting, whether the offspring is begging more than the parent can handle,
right,
or that the parent is providing more than the offspring is begging for.
Right. So the previous story was in relation to the conflict, that obviously it would be to the mother's advantage if offspring have this evolutionary incentive to ask for more food. It would be to the mother's advantage to use substances in the egg to basically shut them up and tell them not to ask for that extra food. And this has become one of the common assumptions of the function of these substances in the egg. But in fact, what we've shown is that it's a slightly more cooperative arrangement than that. And the reason it's cooperative is because of selection that's happened before at the nestling stage. So one way in which this conflict of interests is resolved between parents and their offspring is through the evolution of costly and extravagant begging displays, because that places a limit on how much an offspring is prepared to ask for food. If it has to pay a price for asking for food, then obviously it's not going to ask for all the resources under the sun. And so this in turn means that offspring should be very careful about how they judge how hard to beg for food, because they can't afford to waste resources begging extravagantly for food that's just not going to be delivered. So there's a kind of two-step process in resolving this conflict. The first step is the evolution of costly and extravagant begging displays. So that's a communication of offspring to their mothers. And then there's a second step, which is a prenatal communication step, where mothers tell offspring how hard to beg, so how effectively to deploy their costly begging to get resources. And then the conflict is resolved in this way.
What, if any, implications then does this have for other species?
Well, so one of the key conclusions of our study was that the function of these substances in the egg depends on how much control parents have over provisioning after hatching. So crucial to our result is the fact that canary parents have this intrinsic limit on how they respond to begging, and they won't just feed and feed and feed if their offspring beg a lot. They will put a limit on how responsive they'll be. But it's likely that that's not the case in every species. And when that's not the case, then the substances in the egg might play a different function. So they might not function as a signal in that particular case. So I think what we need to do in future work, and preferably on species living in nature, is to first of all determine who controls food allocation after hatching, whether it's the parents who determine it or the chicks. And then secondly, to determine whether, in the case of parents controlling food allocation, whether these substances in the egg act as messages in the same way as they do in the canaries.
Rebecca Kilner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebecca Kilner of the University of Cambridge is senior author of a paper on parent-offspring conflict and co-adaptation. Members of both parties in the United States Congress have bristled against President Obama's plan for NASA since the release of the presidential budget in February. Now Obama is preparing to push back. He plans to expand on his vision for the space agency at a high-level space summit in Florida next month. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The Obama budget has called for a cancellation of NASA's Constellation program, which was focused on developing a replacement for the soon-to-retire space shuttle fleet and on sending astronauts back to the moon. Critics point out that Constellation, which began under President George W. Bush, has been plagued by a host of cost, scheduling, and technological challenges. If the administration has its way, NASA would instead rely on private contractors for the development of new human spaceflight technologies. This has some members of Congress concerned about job losses due to the abandonment of current NASA projects. Some also question the readiness of the private sector to pick up the mantle of human spaceflight held by NASA for the past several decades. And some lament what they fear is a lack of vision in the Obama plan, which did not initially set forth timetables or destinations for space exploration. Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas, the home state of NASA's Johnson Space Center, has introduced a bill to extend the life of the shuttle program until NASA is confident that a viable replacement vehicle is available. NASA decided to ground the aged shuttle program for budget and safety reasons.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Scientists think life on Earth started in the oceans, but today an estimated 9 out of every 10 species lives on land, assuming you don't count microbes. That means that at some point, life on land flourished in a way that it didn't under the sea. As scientist Elizabeth Panisi reports in this week's issue, two scientists at the University of California, Davis, have linked several hypotheses together to understand the big picture of our world's biodiversity and how it is that oceans have far fewer species than terrestrial habitats. Here's Elizabeth Panisi.
You know, biodiversity is so important to us and to the planet that it's very important to understand the distribution of biodiversity. Where are all the species and why are they there? And these two researchers from the University of California, Davis, have gone through a thought process of trying to figure out why the oceans have so far fewer species than the land. And they've come up with a hypothesis about not only why, but also when this disparity occurred.
Before we get to that, is it even fair to say for sure that there are more species on the land than under the sea? I mean, every time scientists go down, they find new ones, right? And these are big ones even.
Yeah, they do find new ones, but the number of insects and flowering plants vastly outnumber the number of even undiscovered species in the ocean. Now, we're talking about macroscopic species, not microscopic species. But there have been several surveys done, and they come out saying anywhere from 85 to 95% of all species, macroscopic species, are on land.
So what are the scientists saying makes the land environments more conducive to greater speciation than water environments in the first place?
Some of it is sort of the physical characteristics of land. You're living in air. It's easier to move in air. It's easier for you to sense things in air. I mean, smells travel longer distance. Visual cues travel longer distance, things like that. The other thing that has evolved on land is pollinators, and that's been a big deal. The pollinators carry pollen from one plant to another. They can carry it long distances. And what that allows for is for a plant to basically live very far away from its neighbor that it can reproduce with. In the ocean, there's no such thing as pollinators, at least not that anybody knows of, or no examples of where one species will carry the gametes of another species long distance for fertilization or for reproduction.
So what are these scientists saying allowed for the flowering plants and insect pollinators to really take off?
Okay, so diversity on land and sea wasn't always so much in favor of the land. 400 million years ago, there was actually more life in the sea. The sea is an older ecosystem than the land, and at one point was more diverse. But something happened about 110 million years ago, and things started to change. So what happened, according to researchers, is leaves underwent a change, a radical change that enabled them to use water more efficiently. They developed denser veins, and by developing denser veins, they could transport water more efficiently, take in more carbon dioxide, and be more productive. That increased energy into the whole biosphere provided the means for plants to begin to speciate. And as plants started speciating, they started to encourage the evolution of more pollinators and more herbivores and more fungi that would associate with those plants. And so you had a burst of speciation in flowering plants and a burst of speciation in insects and a burst of speciation in fungi. None of this happened in the sea. The sea doesn't have pollinators. It's very hard to move around in the ocean relative to the land. And as a result, the incentive for an animal to carry a reproductive load for another organism is very low.
So the scientists are saying that it's this increased ability of plant leaves to transport water, that that's what led to the speciation of the flowering plants. And then once that really got going, then the pollinators, the insects, those also came along, the fungi to attack the plants, herbivores to eat them, everything on land really began to get going. And that just never happened in the sea.
Right.
How much scientific consensus is there behind this idea?
This is sort of a new idea. The elements have been considered by other people because the role of the physical characteristics of the sea in sort of not encouraging speciation, that's been thought about before by a couple of other people. The importance of leaf vein density on the evolution of flowering plants and then the diversification on land, that's been thought about a little bit. What these two researchers did is sort of put those ideas together and come up with a scenario about how biodiversity, the relative biodiversity between the ocean and the land, changed through time and why.
Elizabeth Panisi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi on how it is that oceans have far fewer species than terrestrial habitats.
Can vaccinations help to resolve conflicts and nurture diplomacy? I think so. They have in the past.
Peter Hotez is Distinguished Research Professor at the George Washington University and President of the Sabin Vaccine Institute in Washington, D.C. His editorial in this week's Science is titled Peace Through Vaccine Diplomacy.
For example, after the 1957 launch of Sputnik, when the United States and Soviet Union were deep into the Cold War, scientists from the two countries entered into a little-known collaboration that led to one of the most important medical advances of the 20th century, the oral polio vaccine. Similar international cooperative efforts with the Soviet Union led to an improved vaccine that eradicated naturally occurring smallpox by 1977 worldwide. Now, polio still persists in Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, and Nigeria. And the Wall Street Journal reported earlier this year that the Taliban leader in Afghanistan is cooperating with the Afghan government and United Nations agencies to eradicate polio in Afghanistan. This suggests to me that there is now an unprecedented opportunity to lock the U.S. and the Islamic nations into a meaningful program of vaccine research and development and potentially improve foreign relations and promote peace. In particular, more than 1 billion people suffer from neglected tropical diseases, including hookworm infection, schistosomiasis, and leishmaniasis. And up to one half of the world's neglected tropical diseases occur in Islamic countries, mainly Indonesia, Pakistan, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Sudan, and to some extent Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. And these diseases, which are a symptom of poverty and disadvantage, are notorious for more than their long-term disabling health effects. They adversely affect rural worker productivity, and that can lead to agricultural insecurity, a condition that increases the likelihood of conflict among groups and states. But the corresponding vaccines for these neglected tropical diseases have essentially no commercial market, relegating their development to nonprofit product development partnerships funded by sources such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the U.S. National Institutes of Health, and the Wellcome Trust. Recently, the pharmaceutical giants Novartis and Merck also initiated global health vaccine development partnerships. But more needs to be done. Joint scientific cooperation between the United States and technologically advanced member countries of the Organization of the Islamic Conference could advance vaccine development for treating neglected tropical diseases in Islamic countries. Indeed, leishmaniasis vaccines are under development in Iran, but these efforts would benefit from greater cooperation with scientific institutions in the West. Last year, the Obama administration launched a new science envoy program to Islamic nations to foster scientific collaboration in ways that address economic, social, and ecological challenges. And later this month, President Obama himself will visit Indonesia, the world's most populous Islamic country, a visit that could establish important scientific ties between the United States and Indonesia and implement a potentially powerful piece of vaccine diplomacy. A vigorous new program of vaccine research and development diplomacy could create opportunities for the United States to address the world's most terrible disease scourges while simultaneously creating a new foreign policy venue. The global beneficial legacy of the oral polio vaccine should spur the United States and its international product development partnerships to connect with scientists in the Islamic world and produce a new generation of life-saving products. The incentive and opportunity to improve international public health, reduce poverty, and promote global security have never been so clear. I'm Peter Hotez.
Peter Hotez is Distinguished Research Professor at the George Washington University and President of the Sabin Vaccine Institute in Washington, D.C. His editorial in this week's Science is titled Peace Through Vaccine Diplomacy. Finally today, Science's Lauren Schenkman is sitting in for David Graham with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about the genes for pain. All the genes for pain, Lauren?
No, they're not, but they do seem to affect how sensitive people are to pain.
What's an example of that sensitivity difference?
Well, you know, some kids, they'll skin their knees and they'll just get up and they'll be laughing, and it's like not a big deal. And then there'll be kids who just cry with the slightest pinch. So you might think that one kid is tough and the other one's a sissy, but that's not the case. There actually could be genetic reasons for why some people are just more sensitive to pain. It's not their fault.
I had understood that women were more tough when it came to pain than men. Is that where the story is going?
No, this is more to do with variations from person to person. It's really small things. So researchers knew that there was this one gene called SCN9A that appeared to play a big role in how people felt pain. If your gene had a really weird mutation, you wouldn't feel any pain at all, actually. And then a different kind of dramatic mutation made people feel pain just all of a sudden for no reason. So they knew this was like a very important gene to pain. But actually, even really tiny changes can change how you experience pain. So there's something called a single nucleotide polymorphism, which is just when you swap one nucleotide or letter for another. And even this tiny, tiny difference can actually lead to two people having different sensitivities to pain. So researchers had looked at hundreds of people with osteoarthritis, which is a really painful condition, and they checked to see what sort of changes they had in this one nucleotide on this gene. And it turned out that people with one certain mutation were just more sensitive to pain. It seemed to be a really kind of strong correlation. And then they looked at a bunch of other people with different kinds of pain, people with backaches, people who had lost limbs who felt pain in the limbs that weren't there, people with pancreatitis, just all different kinds of pain. And when they put the whole picture together, it looked like overall, if you had this mutation, you were just much more likely to have more pain, to report more pain to these conditions.
What does the mutation do?
Well, there's a little ion channel on nerves that helps fire the nerve. And researchers aren't really quite sure what's going on, but when they looked at ion channels that were made with this mutation, they appeared to be not as good as shutting off again. So that would mean that the nerve was firing for longer. It's a subtle thing, so they're not sure if this is the whole story, but at least it's a start. And it could even sort of explain why some people develop chronic pain, because about 20% of the adult population develops chronic pain. It doesn't seem to be tied to the injury they have or to how much damage there is. So there has to be something else going on. So maybe this is the explanation.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, my second story is how a mom's diet while she's pregnant can affect the developing fetus and how it seems to affect male and female fetuses differently.
Is this a study done in people?
No, it's done in mice. They actually had three groups of mice. One group was eating very high-fat diet, one was on a high-carb, low-fat diet, and one on a sort of moderate diet. And so they fed these pregnant mice these different diets, and then about halfway through the gestation period, they ended the pregnancies and looked inside to see how the fetuses were doing. They scanned 40,000 genes and looked to see if there were any that had been expressed differently between the fetuses that had different diets. And they found that the most dramatic changes were in specifically the female fetuses. So there were 211 genes that differed between the high-fat and low-fat groups. But because this was more pronounced in females, it seems like the females are somehow better at responding to the changes in the diet than the males are. So they're able to adapt to the fact that they're getting lots and lots of fat or that they're not getting as much fat.
So these genes helped the fetuses, the female fetuses, respond differently to the diet? What was happening inside the womb?
Well, that's what the researchers think. Because these genes are associated with smell and nutrient filtering, it's as if the females were being better protected from these kind of crazy diets that their mothers were on. On the other hand, even though the male fetuses weren't as protected from these dietary changes, the high-fat diet did seem to help the male fetuses appear like they were going to survive to term, even though the researchers terminated the pregnancies.
Now, you said these genes had to do with smell and nutrient filtering. Is that what researchers were expecting?
Not really, because they thought they would have something to do with metabolism. You know, that makes much more sense. But these genes that regulate smell and nutrient filtering were actually expressed in the placenta. So that suggests the placenta actually does a whole lot for these developing fetuses. For other researchers, it's not such a surprise because the placenta just has so many functions for the developing fetus.
So why not nutrient filtering and smell too?
Yeah, sure, why not? But other researchers pointed out that it's kind of surprising that there would be a distinction between male and female fetuses right away, right from conception. So that's really interesting. But it's unclear how these differences might play out later in life. It could be that male fetuses, because they're exposed to more harmful compounds earlier on, they might be better adapted to high-fat diets later in life. But that's just speculation at this point.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
This last one is about how HIV hides out in the body. It turns out it hides out in bone marrow. And this could explain why in some people who have HIV, they can't detect any of the virus in the blood.
What about HIV hiding in the bone marrow makes it undetectable to these tests?
Well, it's because of the way it infects these bone marrow cells. So even though it affects them, it doesn't make a copy of itself. It's latent. When it makes a copy of itself, it triggers an immune response, and that makes it detectable. But in bone marrow, HIV just seems to kind of hide out and lay low. And that may be why when people who may not have any detectable levels of HIV in their blood, when they go off their medication, the virus just seems to roar back to life.
Are researchers hopeful that this new understanding of where HIV is hiding out will help them figure out how to remove it?
Yeah, the idea is to find drugs that can target these cells where the HIV is hiding out and get them, basically, it's kind of counterintuitive, but get them to make copies of themselves and show themselves, and then they can go about eradicating them. So the idea is to have drugs that can actually make the HIV make a copy of itself in these cells, and that'll kill these cells off, which seems bad, but actually it gets rid of this hiding place for HIV so that HIV is only in places where the drugs that we have right now can actually target it.
But researchers aren't convinced that this is the only hiding place that HIV is using.
That's right. There might be other places in the body where HIV is hiding out, but the fact that they found one is important, and so it gives them something in addition to work on.
Okay, well, thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Lauren Schenkman sitting in for David Graham with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the March 12th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.